The Khan came out from his tent about 30 paces to meet Huan Chuang, who, after a courteous greeting, entered the tent. After a short interval, envoys from China and Cao Chang were admitted and presented their dispatches and credentials, which the Khan perused. He was much elated and caused the envoys to be seated. Then he ordered wine and music for himself and them, and grape syrup for the pilgrim. Hereupon all pledged each other, and the filling and draining of the wine cups made a din and a bustle, while the mingled music of various instruments rose loud. Although the airs were the popular strains of foreigners, yet they pleased the senses and exhilarated the mental faculties. After a while, piles of roasted beef and mutton were served for the others, and lawful food such as cakes, milk, candy, honey, and grapes for the pilgrim. After the entertainment, grape syrup was again served, and the Khan invited Huan Chuang to improve the occasion, whereupon the pilgrim expounded the doctrines of the 10 virtues, compassion for animal life, and the paramitas, and emancipation. The Khan, raising his hands, bowed, and gladly believed and accepted the teaching. Huan Chuang's account of Samarkand is of a large and prosperous city, a great commercial entrepôt, the country about it very fertile, abounding in trees and flowers, and yielding many fine horses. Its inhabitants were skillful craftsmen, smart and energetic. At that time, we must remember, there was hardly such a thing as a town in Anglo-Saxon England. As his narrative approached his experiences in India, however, the pious and learned pilgrim in Huan Chuang got the better of the traveller, and the book becomes congested with monstrous stories of incredible miracles. Nevertheless, we get an impression of houses, clothing, and the like, closely resembling those of the India of today. Then, as now, the kaleidoscopic variety of an Indian crowd contrasted with the blue uniformity of the multitude in China. In the time of Buddha, it's doubtful if there were reading and writing in India. Now, reading and writing were quite common accomplishments. Huan Chuang gives an interesting account of a great Buddhist university at Nalanda, where ruins have quite recently been discovered and excavated. Nalanda and Taxila seem to have been considerable educational centres as early as the opening of the schools of Athens. The caste system Huan Chuang found fully established in spite of Buddha and the Brahmins were now altogether in the ascendant. He names the 4 main castes we've mentioned in chapter 18, but his account of their functions is rather different. The Sudras, he says, were the tillers of the soil. Indian writers say that their function was to wait upon the 3 twice-born castes above them. But as we've already intimated, Huan Chuang's account of Indian realities is swamped by his accumulation of legends and pious inventions. For these he had come, and in these he rejoiced. The rest, as we shall see, was a task that had been set him. The faith of Buddha, which in the days of Asoka and even so late as Kanishka, was still pure enough to be a noble inspiration, we now discover absolutely lost in a wilderness of preposterous rubbish, a philosophy of endless Buddhas, tales of manifestations and marvels like a Christmas pantomime, immaculate conceptions by 6 tusked elephants, charitable princes giving themselves up to be eaten by starving tigresses, temples built over a sacred nail paring, and the like. We can't give such stories here. If the reader likes that sort of thing, he must go to the publications of the Royal Asiatic Society or the India Society, where he'll find a delirium of such imaginations. And in competition with this Buddhism, intellectually undermined as it now was, and smothered in gilded decoration, Brahminism was everywhere gaining ground again, as Huan Chuang notes with regret. Side by side with these evidences of a vast intellectual decay in India, we may note the repeated appearance in Huan Chuang's narrative of ruined and deserted cities. Much of the country was still suffering from the ravages of the ephthalites and the consequent disorders. Again and again we find such passages as this. he went northeast through a great forest, the road being a narrow, dangerous path, with wild buffalo and wild elephants and robbers and hunters always in wait to kill travellers. And emerging from the forest, he reached the country of the Kushinakolo, Kusinagara. The city walls were in ruins, and the towns and villages were deserted. The brick foundations of the old city, that is, the city which had been the capital, were above 10 li in circuit. There were very few inhabitants, the interior of the city being a wild waste. This ruin was, however, by no means universal. There is at least as much mention of crowded cities and villages and busy cultivations. The life tells of many hardships upon the return journey. He fell among robbers. The great elephant that was carrying the bulk of his possessions was drowned. He had much difficulty in getting fresh transport. Here we can't deal with these adventures. The return of Huan Chuang to Xianfu, the Chinese capital, was, we gather, a triumph. Advance couriers must have told of his coming. There was a public holiday. The streets were decorated by gay banners and made glad with music. He was escorted into the city with great pomp and ceremony. 20 horses were needed to carry the spoils of his travels. He had brought with him hundreds of Buddhist books written in Sanskrit and made of trimmed leaves of palm and birch bark, strung together in layers. He had many images, great and small, of Buddha, in gold, silver, crystal, and sandalwood. He had holy pictures, and no fewer than 150 well-authenticated true relics of Buddha. Huan Chuang was presented to the emperor, who treated him as a personal friend, took him into the palace, and questioned him day by day about the wonders of these strange lands in which he had stayed so long. But while the emperor asked about India, the pilgrim was disposed only to talk about Buddhism. The subsequent history of Huan Chuang contains two incidents that throw light upon the mental workings of this great monarch, Tai Tsung, who was probably quite as much a Muslim as he was a Christian or a Buddhist. The trouble about all religious specialists is that they know too much about their own religion and how it differs from others. The advantage or disadvantage of such creative statesmen as Tai Tsung and Constantine the Great is that they know comparatively little of such matters. Evidently the fundamental good of all these religions seemed to Tai Tsung to be much the same fundamental good. So it was natural to him to propose that Huan Chuang should now give up the religious life and come into his foreign office, a proposal that Huan Chuang wouldn't entertain for a moment. The emperor then insisted at least upon a written account of the travels, and so got this classic We Treasure. And finally, Tai Tsung proposed to this highly saturated Buddhist that he should now use his knowledge of Sanskrit in translating the works of the great Chinese teacher Lao Tse, so as to make them available for Indian readers. It seemed, no doubt, to the emperor a fair return and a useful service to the fundamental good that lies beneath all religions. On the whole, he thought Lao Tse might very well rank with, or even a little above, Buddha, and therefore that if his work was put before the Brahmins, they would receive it gladly. In such the same spirit, Constantine the Great had done his utmost to make Arius and Athanasius settle down amicably together. But, naturally enough, this suggestion was repulsed by Huan Chuang. He retired to a monastery and spent the rest of his years translating as much as he could of the Buddhist literature he had brought with him into elegant Chinese writing.
This book is continued on Disc 3.